You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 2nd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, hey.
And Evan Bernstein.
And it was 165 years ago today, July 2nd, 1843, that we lost Mr. Samuel Hahnemann, the creator of homeopathy.
Oh, what a sad day that was.
Yeah, what a sad day.
How did he die? Drown?
Yeah, right.
Now, there were actually a couple of important anniversaries this week, not quite on July 2nd, the day that we're recording, but who knows what happened 150 years ago, July 1st.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's big.
Something.
It's very big. 150 years ago, July 1st, was when Charles Darwin presented his paper and the papers of Wallace at the Linnaean Society. So this was really the birth of evolution.
He presented both Wallace's and his? I did not know that.
I don't think that's where evolution was born. I could be wrong, but I think it started a while ago.
Well, that was the introduction into science, the scientific world that was introduced to evolution on that day. What happened was that Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a younger guy, had pretty much independently come up with a lot of natural selection and evolutionary theory, and he was actually naively corresponding with Charles Darwin and saying, "Oh, Mr. Darwin, what do you think of my ideas?" And Darwin's friends were like, "This kid's going to scoop you. You better do something about this." Ooh. Meanwhile, you know, because Darwin's been taking decades trying to, you know, perfecting his theory before he was going to put it in print. So they convinced him to present both Wallace's paper and his own paper to the Linnaean Society, but Charles Darwin's paper was presented first. So he officially got the precedence for that. But, you know, in all fairness, he had been working on the theory a lot longer and had independently derived it earlier. It's just that he was really dragging his heels on officially publishing it or presenting it to the scientific community.
Wow.
So there we go. That was July 2nd. What else happened this week, 100 years ago, on June 30th?
Oh, 2000. Oh, that was Tunguska, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Tunguska event. So this was. Something exploded over Siberia. Near the Tunguska River. Yeah, and that it probably was a comet or a meteor that got so superheated as it plowed through the atmosphere that it exploded before it hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it left no crater, but blasted the trees for miles around. It was probably traveling about 33,000 miles per hour. It was a 220 million pound space rock, heated to 44,500 degrees. This is what they estimate. The energy of the explosion was equivalent to 185 Hiroshima bombs.
That's, wow.
Boom.
185. 800 square miles of forest was ripped asunder.
Wow.
It's been a controversy for a long time. What was it? Was it a piece of a comet?
Yeah.
Was it a piece of an asteroid? What exactly was it? Because there's apparently for a long time has been no definitive answer on this.
Mm-hmm.
However, recently scientists have been looking into a place called Lake Checo, which is a lake about, I think, 8 miles from the epicenter or from the center of where the explosion took place. And there's scientific research going on now, and there's going to be another scientific team going back later this year, according to Scientific American magazine, to investigate that lake to see if the bed of the lake holds the evidence that it was an asteroid or a meteoroid of some sort.
Are they looking? They're looking for pieces of it.
That's right. They have reason to believe that there is material from the actual meteoroid that is below the sediment on the bottom of the lake, and they're going to be bringing in instruments to try to verify that and drill holes down there.
That would be cool.
Yeah, very cool. So hopefully that, who knows, the 100-year anniversary of this might also be the year that we figure out exactly what happened.
But it was in the news, though, recently. Didn't they determine that the size of the object was smaller than they originally anticipated, meaning that even smaller-sized asteroids are more potentially dangerous than we thought, which basically raises the odds of something something nasty doing lots of damage in the future. So that was in the news, I think, a few months ago.
Yeah, you're refining the computer models of what would happen if we get hit by something. It'd be nasty. Good thing that was over a remote, you know, area of Siberia. Imagine if that were over a metropolitan area. My goodness.
1908 is one thing, but if it happened today, the first thing everyone would think is terrorist attack. It's a nuke that was set off, and then it could prompt an exchange. Right? Imagine some nuclear exchange before people can determine that, hey, this is just a natural thing. So if that happened today, it could be pretty nasty, even much nastier than just the blast itself.
Yeah, although hopefully the scientists, astronomers would know, you know, that this was a meteor and not, because there wouldn't be any missile being launched or anything, right? We would probably know it wasn't a nuclear explosion.
And think about it this way, guys. If the explosion occurred about 4.5 hours earlier, when the Earth was in a different rotation, it was on the exact same latitude line as St. Petersburg, Russia, which was, you know, the capital of Russia at the time. And, you know, probably, if not the most, one of the most densely populated areas. You'd have had quite a catastrophe on your hands there.
It could have changed world history, too.
Oh, certainly. No doubt about it.
Well, we are all back from TAM 6. Last week's episode was what we recorded on Friday and Saturday at TAM 6. But this is actually our first episode that we're recording since being back. And it was quite the ride. I mean, it was amazing.
Fantastic.
It was a lot of fun. It was, you know, it's always fun to record the podcast in person.
Yeah, right?
You guys.
Yeah,
it's true. Nice to see you.
It's different. Do you guys notice that? It was definitely different recording it.
Yeah. It always is, I think, because
live audience.
I don't know. I think it's much better. It's easier. Like, I can see when you guys want to talk, or, you know.
And yeah, plus you had to wear clothes though while we were recording, right?
Yeah,
that's different.
That's true. I'm currently not wearing pants, but also the hotel rooms have air conditioning while my apartment does not.
So there's a chemistry with the audience, certainly.
Totally.
That's there. That's just not there. Right. You know, immediately while we're recording.
I met a lot of awesome people this year. Like, I met a lot of great people last year, but the numbers were much more this year. I feel like I had more time to talk to people. I actually pulled an all-nighter with some of my friends that I met from Australia, who I hope to see again. And overall, you know, TAM is just a fantastic event to go to. I feel very fortunate that we got to go again this year.
Yeah, our listeners were so cool. I mean, it was really great meeting, you know, all the listeners who showed up and who came to our dinner. We actually, like last year, we had a little SGU dinner. Last year, I think
we had like 10.
15. I think 15 people showed up. So we were like, okay, it's going to be bigger this year. So we were planning on maybe 50.
Yeah.
200 people showed up.
Yep.
And they unfortunately, a lot of them had to get turned away at the door because the restaurant.
Sorry,
just,
guys.
Yeah,
sorry.
We will not underestimate next year. We will not.
Yeah, so we're going to have to rethink how to pull this off.
Next year, we're going to buy a restaurant. Buy the whole friggin' thing.
You know, without getting sappy, though, like I want to thank everyone who took the time to come and talk to us and like just let us know that they appreciate the time we put in to do the show. It does really means a lot to us. And
the good news is that we came away with hours of just gold of interviews with so many people. And there are things that happen when you're interviewing live that just can't happen over a Skype interview. For example, we were interviewing Phil Plait. And Adam Savage crashed the interview and sat down and started, you know.
That's awesome.
Mythbusters.
From the Mythbusters. It's awesome. That's the kind of thing that can happen when you're interviewing live at 10. That just is not going to happen.
Phil crashed our talk with Richard Saunders, I think, right?
Yeah.
He tried to get a few words
Phil
in.
Paid it forward.
Yeah. So keep an eye out for that. Although this week we have upcoming an interview with Dr. Dean Adel.
Yeah.
So we had the opportunity to interview
him
this week.
America's doctor.
America's doctor. America's it's a great doctor. Interview. So that's this week. Next week we'll start with the TAM interviews. Let's go on and do a few news items. Unfortunately, creationism is in the news yet again, this time in Louisiana, which doesn't have a great track record for this sort of thing. The Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal signed Senate Bill 733 into law. This is the Balanced Treatment for Evolution Science and Creation Science Act. Oh boy. This is the latest tactic of the Discovery Institute and creationists and intelligent design proponents to basically, they can't get creationism in through the front door of public education, so they're trying to create a back door. And that back door is under the guise of academic freedom, giving teachers and educators the freedom to introduce other theories or other ideas about the life origins, or to introduce criticism of evolution as if, you know, there's this big dogmatic conspiracy to shield evolution from any scientific criticism. Like, oh, no one would ever dare criticize evolution as a theory. It's all just made up nonsense. But unfortunately, they're getting another round of legal mischief out of this tactic. So we're going to have to keep an eye on this until it starts to come up to court cases, but it almost certainly will.
You know, he's a potential vice presidential candidate for McCain.
Not anymore, I hope.
Oh, you think that he's out?
Well, so Jindal his name has cropped up as a possible running mate for John McCain. Personally, I think that...
What a disaster that would be.
McCain needs to court independence if he's going to win, and if he... Yeah, if he takes on Jindal, I mean, I think he would have no chance of winning, and he probably knows that. This is what Jindal had to say. Let's talk about intelligent design. I'm a biology major. That's true. This guy's a biology major. Isn't that scary? That's my degree. The reality is there are a lot of things that we don't understand. There's no theory in science that could explain how, contrary to the laws of entropy, you could create order out of chaos.
Oh, wrong. Come on.
There's no scientific theory that explains how you can create organic life out of inorganic matter. Irrelevant.
Irrelevant.
Non sequitur.
I think we owe it to our children to teach them the best possible modern scientific facts and theories.
I agree.
That I agree with.
Yeah.
Hey, look at that. We do agree. Yeah.
Teach them what different theories are out there for the things that aren't answerable by science. Well, that's a contradiction. Yep. If it's not answerable by science, then there's no scientific theory about it. How can you have a scientific theory about something that's not answerable by science? He's just profoundly confused. He goes on, let them decide for themselves. Oh, I hate that line.
Yeah.
Let them decide. Let's teach them utter crap and then let them decide the truth for themselves. He says, I don't think we should be scared to do that. Personally, it certainly makes more sense to me that when you look at creation, you would believe in a creator.
Uh-huh.
Well, gee, if it makes more sense to this guy, we should teach it as science in the public school system. So, you know, this is just that's creationist propaganda down the line. Again, it's all complete nonsense. It doesn't even make internal sense. But this, again, there's going to be another round of mischief out of this. Someone commented on the National Center for Science Education. They have a good article on this particular one, and somebody commented that what this is going to do, it's going to force Louisiana taxpayers to give a big chunk of cash to the Discovery Institute because people are going to buy their crappy textbooks, and then they're going to have to give a big chunk of cash to lawyers when these things get challenged in the courts, which they will, and they will lose. So this is just a huge waste of money for Louisiana residents, basically. The next news item is a bit of tech news that has the word nano in it.
Go ahead, Jay.
Take it away, Bob.
Oh, sorry.
So it must be good. This is yet
billions of dollars.
This is yet another. hey! Don't steal my thunder. It seems like there's new battery technology stories coming out every day. This one actually looked a little more plausible than a lot of these other ones. Stanford researchers have developed a process for creating silicon nanowires that basically reinvents the rechargeable lithium-ion batteries that are pretty much ubiquitous. The new technology produces more than 10 times the amount of electricity of existing lithium-ion batteries. So, for example, if your laptop runs for about 2 hours on your battery, which is, I guess is pretty close to the average, you could do about 20 hours. And one of the big goals for battery technology is to make it so that your laptop battery can survive a trip across the ocean. So, say 4, 5, 6 hours is like one of the goals, so that you don't have to plug it in and you could do whatever you want and not have to bring an adapter or whatever with you. 20 hours would just blow that out of the water.
Yeah, you could use it all day. Just charge it overnight. That'd be awesome.
The assistant professor of material science and engineering at Stanford, Yi Kui, says that it's not a small improvement. It's a revolutionary development. I agree. That would be quite an order of magnitude increase. Would be pretty cool. Now, a lithium-ion battery that is so greatly improved would be a boon for electric car manufacturers. They would just be all over that. or even batteries that store electricity. Say your rooftop's got solar panels. They could be used to store electricity using this technology. And one of the things that really interested me was that given the, according to Kui, given the mature infrastructure behind silicon, he says that this new technology can be pushed to real life quickly. So that's definitely a huge boon. Now, the reason why this even works is that the storage capacity of these types of batteries depends on the amount of lithium in the anode. Typically, this is made of carbon. Now, using silicon as an anode can store a lot more. But the problem is that they swell and shrink as they take in lithium, and that causes them to slowly decay and destroy themselves. So, silicon was abandoned, I think, decades ago after they researched it. But of course, using nanotechnology, they found a way to create a forest of nanowires. Each of them having a diameter of about a thousandth of that of paper. And they swell four times their normal size, but then they shrink back down, and they stay intact. Now, Kui said that he's got a patent application filed with this, and he's considering the formation of a company or an agreement with a battery manufacturer. There's lots of battery technology stories out there. This one is one of the few that really seem really exciting to me and really seem more feasible than the others. And one of the real reasons is that the silicon industry is such a mature industry. Anything that's made of silicon can be relatively quickly adapted to this new application. And according to Kui, his method can scale up very easily. So the bottom line is, we need to put millions of dollars into this.
Yeah.
And just millions?
Millions, yeah. I'd say millions first.
This one doesn't really need billions.
See if it pans out, and then if it really looks good, then we could put billions.
So these stories are always exciting to read about, and you just think about it. Like you apply this to electric cars. It would transform electric cars. I mean, if suddenly we're getting 500-600-mile range
out of a
purely electric car, I mean, that just completely changes the whole nature of the equation. But you just never know if they're going to pan out. You know, that is this going to be scalable on an industrial level? Are they going to be able to, you know, convert the manufacturing process to one that can be industrialized, that can be mass produced? Are they going to run into other problems or limitations that they haven't, you know, encountered yet? So there's still, you know, hurdles to go.
Are the oil industry is going to buy them out? Right? Is it the common response?
Yeah, but you know that's kind of silly. I mean, it's published in Nature Nanotechnology, right? So this is a pretty high profile journal. It's out there. I mean, the notion is out there. So, but anyway, I really hope this kind of thing pans out because it would be awesome.
There's so much focus on this technology because obviously the benefit would be so huge. I really think we're going to see some major leaps in battery technology in the next 10 years with so much focus, so much money focused on this.
Yeah.
I think somebody's got to hit it, and I don't think it's going to be too long before we see some amazing stuff. Maybe this is it, but even if this isn't, something's going to click. Maybe the ultracapacitor or something.
Something.
The benefit is just with gas at $140 a barrel?
Over, yeah.
Today it was over 140, yeah.
Yeah,
the economics are becoming feasible for these technologies because, you know, gas is no longer cheap. But and Bob, I remember reading about this for like a couple of years now, the whole application of nanotechnological manufacturing processes to battery technology, and a lot of people were saying this is going to transform batteries because once you can start to form structures at this fine a scale, then that enables you to do a lot of really interesting things in terms of moving ions around and improving the capacity, et cetera. But this is the first one where you actually have something real published in the literature that works, so...
Well, I don't know. I think there might be more than you think. And a lot of this, you know, they throw nano around a lot. And in a sense, this is nanotechnology because these structures that they're building are built at the nano scale. And that's great. But I'm just waiting for the time when we're not just creating structures at the scale, but we're actually creating devices that can actually do things at the scale. And that time will come as well. But in the meantime, we'll just enjoy this application of nanotechnology.
Right. One more quick news item before we go on to a couple of emails. This is a bit of SGU news. We've started to branch out into a new medium. We have several YouTube videos on
Skeptic Porn.
The Skeptic's Guide YouTube channel.
All the kids are talking about?
What's this YouTube? So what we decided to do, we've been working on videos this year. This is one of our projects that we've been working on. But it's really hard making videos. We're still doing it. It's just taking a lot longer than we anticipated. So one other thing that we decided to do that was kind of on our list that we just moved up to the top of the list of our long list of things that we want to do is to produce some YouTube short clips out of segments that we've already recorded. So what we did was take some like 5 to 7 minute topics that we talked about on our podcast that had a lot of visual elements to them. So for example, a couple of the first ones we did were the fake alien video, and we also did one on the 5x5 episode we did on a ghost photographs. So yeah, you know, video and photos, we can talk about them to some degree on the podcast, but you could really enhance that content by actually illustrating and showing the pictures of everything that you're talking about. So this is enhanced content for our listeners. We are also going to use some clips that never made it into the podcast, so you might actually find some brand new material there. But also the primary purpose of this is to help get the word out. What we'd like to do, you know, is if you will stop by and take a look at the videos that we have up there on YouTube, give us suggestions for the segments that you'd like to see there, and email it to your friends. You know, we'd like to get this to go viral, you know, as much as possible. We think this could really help spread the word, and it's a good way to sort of introduce people into the podcast, give them a taste of the kind of things that they would hear on the show.
You know, just for the record, things don't normally go viral because you ask nicely.
Yeah, I know, but we have, you know, what do we got, 40,000 listeners? That's a good way to...
Yeah, I'm just saying,
that'll,
you know,
jumpstart it. That'll jumpstart it.
The language is all.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, good job with that, Steve.
Thank you. And Mike Lassell did one of the videos, mm-hmm. too. He's going to be helping us with that as well, so thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, let's go on to a few of your questions and emails. First one comes from Graham Lappin from Harrogate, UK. And he writes, the UK Skeptics Forum has been having a little fun with suggestions for a collective noun for skeptics. Some of the suggestions so far have been a doubt of skeptics, a pub of skeptics, an inquiry of skeptics, an argument of skeptics, an inquisition of skeptics, to name just a few. If there is a little time on the podcast, the rogues might want to extend the fun across the Atlantic. Come to think of it, how about a rogue of skeptics?
Ooh.
All the best and keep up the inspirational work. Well, thanks, Graham. Yeah, we thought this was kind of fun. So you know, there are plural or collective nouns for creatures or stuff. I mean, you could act as a very fun website, the collective noun page. And you know, for example, like there's a stand of trees, a string of ponies,
a murder of crow.
Murder of crows is always
I love it.
My favorite one.
I like a doubt. I like a doubt of skeptics.
You like a doubt of skeptics?
Kind of a nice ring to it.
My favorite of those was an inquiry of skeptics.
Yeah, but then do you say inquiry? Do you say inquiry?
That's true. That's true.
There's
a deal killer there. Yeah,
I got a few of my own suggestions. A cognate of skeptics.
No.
All right. How about this one? You're gonna like this one. A universe of skeptics.
That ties
back into The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. How about, if you wanted to go with a more of a geeky science angle, a beaker of skeptics?
No. Beaker of
That's
skeptics.
Funny.
Or my favorite one, an illumination of skeptics.
Hmm.
Ooh.
Oh, that's nice. That's got a nice ring to it. Although that does call to mind the unfortunate Bright incident.
That's true, but still illumination.
But I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Wow.
But what do you got? Let me see what you guys got. Can you guys have some suggestions?
I got a few. How about, not my favorite, I'll save my favorite for last, a perspicacity of skeptics.
Oh, yeah, Bob, that'll ring. Yeah, that'll okay, ring off of every.
That rolls right off the tongue.
All right, okay. That's not my favorite. It's not my favorite. Steve, this reminds me of yours, a cogent of skeptics.
Cogent is good.
And my favorite, a percipience of skeptics.
Percipience.
What is this, Bob? The SATs, well, yeah, Bob? Jesus.
These are great words. These are great words. Come on.
Did Bill Buckley write those for you, Bob? What's going on? I like a culture of skeptics.
That's like a culture of bacteria.
Exactly. Science. That's right. That's exactly,
or a cult,
that's exactly
of
right.
Skeptics.
There's a cult. Sort of a double entendre there. And how about a sleuth of skeptics?
Ooh, a sleuth of skeptics.
There's already a sleuth,
right, a sleuth of
like
so? Who cares?
Badgers or something.
Yeah, but screw them. I mean, we'll take that. And
why do badgers get to be sleuths?
For the record, percipience means discerning and discriminating, so I thought it was very appropriate.
Yeah, okay. That's good.
What do you got, girlfriend? Come on.
Bring it on.
I don't have anything. I prefer to simply denigrate all your choices. A nerddom.
A nerddom of skeptics.
A geekery of skeptics.
I got one for you, Rebecca. A proposal of skeptics.
A proposal. But what about true believers? We need a collective noun for true believers.
The deceit of believers.
An arrogance of true believers.
That's a good one.
I would say an embarrassment, but that already is something, right?
An embarrassment?
Oh, is it?
An embarrassment of parents, an embarrassment of riches are on the list. No, an embarrassment of true believers. That one works.
How about a flock of dodos? Oh, wait, no. That's been done.
Zing.
An effluvium of true believers.
Effluvium.
How about a scumbag of creationism? Creationists.
Scumbag. No, or a douchebag.
Oh, okay.
A douchebag of true believers. A douchebag of psychics.
That's what it is.
A douchebag of psychics.
Game over. Yep, that's done. Write that one down.
That's nice. I like
okay. Well, let's go on.
Ooh, I got one. A delusion of true believers.
Delusion of true believers. Well, let's go on. The next email comes from Patrick Orlob from Salt Lake City, Utah. And Patrick writes, "So I love working for my boss, but occasionally I get to hear about her latest adventures in drinking from the well of woo. She has rejected contemporary medicine in favor of a naturopath. Today I heard the most ridiculous thing. She was telling me about how walnuts are wonderful for brain health, tomatoes for heart health, and celery is good for the bones. The reason? Tomatoes have four chambers, just like the heart. Walnuts look like brains, and celery looks like bones."
Can't beat that logic.
Can't beat it. "I immediately thought this might be something you guys would be interested in. I did a bit of Googling and found this website featuring a chainmail. This nonsense seems almost homeopathic in its logic."
It's really bad. It's really, really ridiculously bad.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know that this doesn't work because I spent a whole month eating nothing but enormous melons.
Yeah, I've been eating these bananas and, you know.
Oh, thank you. I'll be here all week. The very first one, the tomatoes. Tomatoes have four chambers, and that's why they're good for your heart. I've eaten a lot of tomatoes. I've never seen a chamber. Can someone tell me what a chamber is in a tomato?
Well, if you like slice them open, they have little compartments. Yeah. You know, they're not really hollow.
No,
they're not
they
chambers.
Don't.
They're just.
Yeah, it's
I
like,
think they're just. I would,
it's like jelly
like you
inside
can,
instead
you can
of
cut yeah. them and
a green
in fours,
would be
but,
more of a chamber-like vegetable.
Yeah, that I would call a chamber, but that's one chamber. So, I don't know. In the website with the chain email, actually the first one on there is great. "A sliced carrot looks like the human eye." What? Where are you getting your carrots? That is gross. Or, what is wrong with your eye? Because, again, I've eaten a lot of carrots. I've never sliced one and been like, oh, that looks just like an eye. What? No.
There's a link to a video for a show called God Tube.
Oh, I love God Tube. God Tube isn't a show. God Tube is – it's like YouTube but for Christians.
It takes itself seriously. I mean it's not farce.
No, it's hysterical.
Yeah, it looked like it took itself seriously, and it goes over this whole thing. I mean seriously, it does the carrot, the tomato. Then it shows an avocado is like a woman's womb. And that's it's good for
that's hilarious.
For the health. Yeah, and grapes look like
my womb looks like an avocado. Really?
Yeah.
if my womb ever looks like an avocado, I'm going to the doctor immediately.
Right. The one that I mean, they said that a sweet potato looks like a pancreas. No, that's a real stretch. So this is sympathetic magic. You know, this is just it looks like it, therefore it heals. It is homeopathic. You know, it is like cures like or. Like a lot of local like magical remedies or magic potions, for example, we'll use things like a rhino horn for impotence or just for sexual prowess because it's a horn. It looks like an erect penis. You know, that's sympathetic magic. It looks like it, therefore it helps it. It's totally absurd.
But this is like pareidolia where like people are seeing Jesus in, like oil stains and you can't even see it even after they point it out. Like, grapes hang in a cluster that has the shape of a heart?
Yeah.
What? Go have your heart checked. If you
More like hemorrhoids.
Your heart should not look like a cluster of grapes.
Cauliflower, I always thought cauliflower looked a lot like a human lung. You got that kind of because you have the multiple branching.
Oh, because it branches off.
Yeah, I mean, so some of the similarity is just first of all, you got a lot of vegetables and fruits to choose from, you know. And if you're willing to make that loose a connection, I mean, you know, it's not difficult to say that it looks a little bit like it.
Yeah, it's like if you carve a potato into the shape of a heart. No.
But here's the other fallacy in here. So on GodTube, they actually make the argument that this is proof for intelligent design.
Yeah.
You know? Forgetting about the fact that all of the vegetables and fruits that they're using as examples looked nothing like they currently look the way they...
Oh, you mean they evolved?
They naturally evolved. These were all cultivated to look the way that they do through thousands of years of, you know, human selection. I mean, these are cultivated to be this way. Everything we eat is not how it appeared in nature 10,000, 15,000 years ago.
There's hardly anything left that resembles what it was.
Let's just put ourselves in God's shoes for a minute and say, why would you do that?
Right.
Like, so ancient man could know that, oh, this cluster of grapes looks just like the heart that is beating inside my chest that I can't see.
Right.
That means I should eat this now.
I'm gonna eat more cucumbers.
What would blueberries?
Let us know how that works out.
What would blueberries be good for?
Come on, now talk about the setup.
But does that mean that cherries will give you hemorrhoids?
No, they'll...
No, you'll lose your virginity.
Right.
Come on, give me another one.
Watermelon?
Kumquat.
Oh, that's too easy. Actually, watermelon. There was a study that just came out that said watermelon does improve...
erectile dysfunction.
May improve sexual health.
Yeah.
Right?
It has some Viagra-like effects.
Yeah.
There you go.
And which obviously makes sense because watermelon looks just like a penis.
Just right? like it. Oh, yeah.
I've never actually seen a penis.
Apparently. So, yeah, this is pretty far out there. But the fact that somebody would actually take this as a serious argument is just incredible. Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Dean Adel. Dr. Adel, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure to be here and to be among skeptics. That's a rare opportunity. Pull up, trust me.
Oh, great. So for those who may not know, Dr. Dean Adel is a popular syndicated radio talk show host, the Dr. Dean Adel Show, over 400 radio stations. And the figure I heard is 6 million listeners. Is that currently accurate?
Up and down, anywhere between 2 to 6, depending on a good week or a bad week, and who's being skeptical and who's not.
Right.
Wow.
But also the anchor of Medical Minutes, and also has been on many television shows like the Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel, basically doing yeoman's work, spreading skepticism, and also educating the public about good scientific medicine. First, if you don't mind my asking, how did you decide to shift your career into being a media doctor?
Oh, this is a sordid tale. I don't know if you got a couple of hours here. To tell you the truth, when I finished medical school and residency, I wasn't really happy with medicine, and I kind of quit for a while and went off and did a whole bunch of other things for 5, 6, 7 years, about 7 years to be exact, all kinds of fantasies, wanting to be an artist, and I ran an antique store, and one day, out of the blue, this is the serendipity of life and how it happens. I don't have to believe in astrology or anything else to be in awe of the life process. A woman gets off a bus and walks into I had a jewelry shop at the time, and says, me doctor's down the drunk tank. And to help out doing physicals on the clientele. It was $50 a day, and I was starving in jewelry making. And I went down there, met a guy who said, you know, you speak like a human being. You don't talk like a doctor. And I had been away from medicine for a while. And he said, I got a friend of a friend who has a radio station. It'd be a really cool thing if people could just call up and ask questions and get honest answers.
Wow.
So that's kind of how that was started. The guy knocked on my door and dragged me to meet a woman. It was a country music station. It was the scariest thing in the world. Of course, I went to, this was in Sacramento, California. So I ran off the UC Davis bookstore and bought a textbook of internal medicine and surgery and tried to, you know, start the learning process all over again. And as it began and moved forward, you know, there were lots of questions that people had and a lot of things people were falling for and misbeliefs and fantasies. And slowly but surely, you know, I realized how, A, hungry people are for knowledge, but how easily they're duped and how they're often misled by so many things that they do see in media and television and radio. And I worked as a television a health reporter for 30 years for ABC, and I've done a lot of television work. And it's even more bleak there, because at least on radio and a talk show, someone can call up and straighten you out and tell you the truth, or at least argue with you. In television, you know, it's Ken and Barbie looking in the camera with a script in them, often written by someone who may not know what they were writing.
So you find that you have to correct a lot of just bad medical journalism out there.
Oh, yes. It's horrible. It's really horrible. The sources of information are never checked. What is seen as controversy is not, you know, 99.9% of physicians agree and feel one way, and they'll go out of the way, the television station, to find that 0.1% and call it a genuine controversy, and confuse the public. And of course, there are many different forces, at work trying to sell people things, and often the average television reporter can't tell the difference. I mean, that's why I welcome physicians getting involved in media. It used to be a very rare thing. It's fairly common today, but nevertheless, it's a good thing, because other than that, doing medical news, well, it was often given to the reporter at the lowest rung, you know, who didn't want to do it, never may have taken even a biology course and had no idea what they were doing. And yet it's so important. People really listen to the folks on television. And, you know, we'll go on crazy diets, take stupid supplements, fall for, you know, rip off herbs, and before you know it, they can often harm themselves.
Why do you think that is? Why is medical journalism the standard so low on average?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it never really existed before. Well, I was not the first. I was at least second, maybe the third, you know, television doctor out there to, you know, make it nationally. And at that particular point, there were no standards, because nobody, you know, first of all, it was considered inappropriate for physicians to get involved. I remember when I was in practice, there was a local surgeon who went on a local television show. And boy, he was severely chastised by the medical society for self-promotion.
You know, the number of specific claims or pseudosciences, even just within medicine, forget about all of science, is just too great to combat on an individual basis, that you really have to teach people how to think so that they can sort their way through it themselves. You just can't give them the answer. So how do you approach that on your show?
Well, you know, I try to keep it simple, and I figure, first of all, if people understand the basis of the placebo effect alone, if they can just grasp and respect that, that can often guide them through a whole bunch of stuff. And then from there, you know, I step it down and think about, why is somebody selling me this? And if there were indeed a way to lose 50 pounds over a weekend, you know, there wouldn't be any fat doctors around, you know, because we get fat too. And we get cancer and we die also. And to try to think with simple logic and plain old common sense. And you'd be amazed how many people, you know, I get a lot of calls from people who are calling me because indeed they are skeptical. They're asking me about stuff that I can't imagine that they would fall for. But they've come to the line, they've used their own reasoning, and they've determined that they have some doubts. And so when they're calling me, they're often calling because they're skeptical. The suckers don't call until after they think, you know, they've been ripped off. So I try to come up with simple, basic principles in telling them how to evaluate it. And I say to them, listen, if you get confused and, you know, your neighbor's trying to sell you some supplement, just ask them. Ask them for the piece of paper upon which the research is based. I said, it's fair to ask your doctor that. I said, as physicians, we don't do anything that isn't based on research that I couldn't put my finger on, you know, and show you. So when someone's trying to sell you some phony baloney deal, you know, ask them for the data upon which that's based. And when you see them run the other way and hem and haw, then your common sense should kick in. But I still am amazed that you know, people would never buy a car if, you know, they were told it gets 75 miles to the gallon or, you know, some pill you put in the tank. They're absolutely clear on some of the standard kind of scams, but when it comes to their health, they would immediately fall for somebody telling them, take this pill, you'll live to be 100 years. And there's something about biology and the human mechanism that, you know, allows us to, you know, to fall for things more quickly. And I think sometimes as scientists, we try to explain things to people with data. You know, there was a classic, I'm sure you know about this. I mean, here, the simplest example is if someone, you know, wants to buy a new car, and they go to Consumer Reports, and they get all the data about the mileage, the reliability, et cetera, and they go to work, and someone says, hey, my aunt has a car like that, it's a lemon, that will totally trash all the data. So when people see somebody in an infomercial claiming, I lost 25 pounds over the weekend, or I cured cancer, that's a very powerful thing to the human brain, and that seems to take precedence over all the data and the numbers. So I think attacking it with data and numbers sometimes, you know, doesn't carry it, and people are skeptical of scientists. They don't trust us. They learn to think that, you know, they watch too many evil scientist movies. But I think when you confront it, you know, head on, and talk to them about what other mechanism could explain, you know, what happened there. And I spent a lot of time talking about the natural history of disease, and that sometimes colds go away by themselves. And whatever you do that day that it went away, you think is a cure. And I like to talk about, you know, relaxing diseases like multiple sclerosis that can come and go, and how you have to know what a disease will do by itself before you can, you know, claim that the local, you know, supplement you took, you know, cured the illness. And then I talk about the law. I think the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act is a, you know, an incredible piece of legislation, because I say, what if they did that when it came to your automobile or any other walk of life? You know, imagine if they were sloppy when it came to, you know, airplanes and airlines. You know, if you fly in a plane that, you know, had to subject itself to zero proof of efficacy or safety. And you know, try to bring in the common sense thing. And I think most people, when it's explained to them correctly, will get it. I think. I hope. Otherwise, all is lost.
Right. So we're definitely fighting an uphill battle against human nature. Just the, as you said, for example, being much more compelled by personal stories than by scientific data. But now we're also fighting a very well-organized and very slick marketing campaign, you know, so-called complementary and alternative medicine. I mean, it's almost literally like the con artists have figured out how to put the big con over everybody. I mean, and you've seen that happen. What's your perspective on that, on the last 20 years of this whole phenomenon?
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, I was an old hippie doctor, you know, and I actually was there at the beginning of all this in the 60s, of alternative and holistic, we called it then. Couldn't figure out how to spell holistic. Was it W-H or was it H? And so I myself kind of went through becoming a holistic doctor, and then got to straighten myself out and saw how sloppy my thinking was, and realized that it was really all wishful thinking, and it was, you know, anti-establishment stuff. That's what really the 60s was all about. And, you know, we wanted it to, why couldn't an herb cure disease? Well, it can, and so many of our prescription drugs came from herb. But the thing is, we tested them, extracted, and did our double-blind studies to find out that they worked, as opposed to today. Just because it's an herb or it's something ancient, therefore it works. I mean, my favorite thing is it's natural. I love that one. I get calls from people all the time. I say, yeah, so are earthquakes and cocaine and tobacco natural, you know, and yet that's not really really good for you. Well, here comes this, quote, alternative thing. And to me, it's just it's an umbrella for, you know, for quackery. I'll just put it frankly. I mean, either something works or it doesn't work. This is not complicated. We would all love to see gentle therapies cure all human ills. And it is wishful thinking, but boy, it's a loophole. And through that loophole, I know some genuinely caring and reasonable thinking physicians who go in there and want to help people. And listen, if I had a practice and I had someone in great pain, I suppose if I had a correct diagnosis, I wouldn't object too much if they wanted to try acupuncture versus giving them OxyContin. I mean, there's a time in medicine when a wise physician might want to use, quote, placebo medicine, or try to take advantage of the power we have and the belief to heal. I have no objection to that. I do have objection, you know, where in California you can take your headache to an acupuncturist primarily, and, you know, you find out too late that it was, you know, it wasn't a migraine, it's a meningioma. or I can't tell you how many people I've had in my career in radio and friends and relatives who started out with backaches going to, you know, body workers who I think can be part of medical care, but, you know, figured out later on it was metastatic cancer to the spine. So, yeah, I feel, and you got to be very careful when you, you know, announce yourself as anti any of this stuff. You get labeled as, oh, you're just a stuffy old scientist, you know, and you just sort of don't want the challenges from all these wonderful new age thinking people. And it's so appealing. It's a big, big topic on television. I mean, Oprah's not going to put a regular doctor on. She wants somebody who's going to sell the power of, you know, magical thinking, because that's what her audience is into. I've never been on Oprah. We don't get along very well. But I know all her people. I know her new favorite pet doctor very well, Dr. Oz. I know him very well. And I've met a lot of, quote, alternative types, and I love to, you know, in a quiet room, I say, come on, give me a break. Where'd you go to medical school? You know what studies are, what placebos are, and all that. And I get a variety of answers. A lot of them will say, yeah, but this is what the people want, and I'm not going to hurt them. And as long as, you know, I'm making sure that if there is rational treatment that can cure them, that they get that, you know, so I sell them some placebos, they get better, they pay me, end of subject. I don't have to deal with insurance companies. And then I get some who actually believe their own hype, who just don't seem to have the ability to understand, you know, how you evaluate data. And I don't know, maybe in some medical schools they don't pay enough attention to this. How do you read a paper and decide if it's a good paper and it's a reasonable therapy to try in human beings? I can't really address that. But it is remarkable, and I have no problem getting into discussions and arguments with some of these docs, and yeah, okay, we harm people in medicine, but we also cure them, and nothing, you know, I think one of the misperceptions out there is people want a perfect world, and I always use the automobile as an example. I go, listen, you're in California, take a 1 in 3,000 chance of killing yourself every year by driving a car, and you somehow expect technology that's going to make you well. It comes without a risk. I can't think of any new technology ever introduced to human civilization that didn't have risks and downsides, you know, to it. There's a price to be paid for anything that's positive in life. And yet the public doesn't quite get that. And so now we've got, you know, complementary medicine, alternative medicine, a lot of people capitalizing on it, making a lot of money. And once again, I'm all for, let's research every herb you can get your hands on. But once it dies and it doesn't work, get rid of it. It's a remarkable thing to me that I do study after study, and I come from a long line of vitamin makers. My parents made multiple vitamins when I was a kid. Listen, it put me through medical school. I'm biting the hand that fed me, I guess. But, I mean, how many now double-blind studies do we have to do to find that vitamins are basically worthless for most people trying to prevent, you know, cardiovascular disease and cancer, and yet sales aren't off? You can find, you know, the big herbs, you know, in the last 10 years, the one that came on the scene big time, do a double-blind study, find they're worthless. It does not influence sales. It's amazing. Chondroitin and glucosamine for arthritis. We keep doing the studies, they're worthless, and sales keep going up and up and up. It's remarkable to me that that science can't change the course of this. And, well, it tells you once again, like as we talked about before, that marketing and the power of the dollar to buy media time is overwhelming when it comes to simple science, which is just simply trying to tell people the truth.
Certainly, I agree with you that DSHE, you know, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 94, shows that in this arena, the free market is going to favor just abject irrationality. And that's why we need regulation. But there, the government is essentially totally failing the public. I mean, they're essentially endorsing quackery and nonsense and not providing the protections that should be in place, and that I think that most of the public assume falsely are in place. So how do we make headway in that arena?
Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. The public assumes that if it's on the shelves at their local drugstore, that it must be safe and effective. And I got to tell you, as a kid and having talked to my father over the years, the FDA was very strong and powerful in the early days of the vitamin hype. And they were constantly trying to battle them and fight them, and they wreaked havoc with it until, you know, the current act. And it is it's a difficult area. I certainly am one. I don't know if I would see it practical to impose, you know, the same standards we have for pharmaceutical medicines on over-the-counter herbs and food supplements. I can see why Connor would fell for all this. After all, it's just a food. Well, of course, you can call anything a food supplement. And yet there is an over-the-counter market. In the over-the-counter market, there are criteria that apply. And if you want to sell an over-the-counter product to people and you want to claim that it's effective for their health, I'm not sure I wouldn't agree with applying the same standards. And listen, I have no problem with herbal medicine, you know, that might work or help. And I could so easily see, and listen, so many of these companies are owned, these herbal companies and supplement companies are owned by the big boys, you know. They're buying them up because it's good business. They're cheap to make them. Standards and quite something, and I think industry is just too strong, and their ties to Congress too strong that you could ever, you know, require them to meet the same standards that regular over-the-counter medicines have to meet. And I've seen a lot of products that, you know, the manufacturer face smaller companies say, listen, I can go the straight route and try to get this in the OTC market the straight way, or I can just call it a supplement, and I'm in the store next week, and you can see it's very, very tempting.
In your career, how much do you promote yourself as a scientist versus calling yourself a skeptic?
There's an elegant beauty to scientific truth, and it's worthy of pursuit. But you say the word skeptic, and people think it has a negative connotation. Yeah. And people think, oh, you're just going to poo-poo everything. You're just so negative. I love that when you tell someone the truth, and they say, oh, you're just so negative.
Closed-minded.
Yeah, closed-minded. I got to say, and I've said many times in the radio, the most closed-minded people I have ever met in my life have been the alternative types. You know, a question I got it from some skeptic, I don't know where, maybe I read it in one of the magazines, but, you know, when I meet people who have these kinds of minds, I say, well, what kind of evidence could I present to you that would change your mind? That usually stops the conversation.
Oh.
It's like they've never thought in that direction, because I say, to me, I can sit here and list all day long the kind of evidence you could give me that would change my mind about XYZ. But what kind of evidence would it take for you? And they immediately reveal how close-minded they are, because I've had people say, yeah, there's nothing. I'm absolutely right. You know, I'm sure. You know, or there isn't. It stops them from thinking, because most thinking people would think about the evidence that would take them to change their mind. You know, I get in an argument with my wife, you know, and I'm afraid she might come up with evidence. I'm going to have to change my mind, period. And the subject, that's the beauty of science as opposed to politicians, you know. So it's a conundrum. What can I tell you? We need a marketing company. You know, needs a new word. But I like curious. I like that, and I like. I don't know what I like. I struggle with this. If I had a good name, I'd promote it.
It's just going to take time. You know, like anything else, I think people's perceptions will change over the years.
Right. And I think we're seeing that. I think we're stuck with the term. But on the bright side, I'm kind of noticing that the past few years, it kind of seems that it's the word skeptic is kind of getting a little bit of a better connotation about it. Not so much. People aren't so readily equating it with cynical or cynic. It's a little bit of a change. I don't think it's the knee-jerk reaction isn't there like it quite used to be. It's Steve, wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. 10 years ago, when I cashing a check at the bank, whatever, this is for the New England Skeptical Society, people would laugh. their immediate knee-jerk reaction was to laugh and go, like, what is that? Now, I think they equate it with science, which is exactly what we want. So we're making some progress.
Well, thank God for that, huh?
Yeah, we're kind of stuck with the word because nobody can come up with a better word, you know, like the brights or whatever. Yeah. Just is not, nothing is happening.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we're stuck making the best word.
It's got to rebrand it.
So Dr. Dean, what's in your future? What are you going to do for the next 30 years?
You know, I'm a guy who's had a lot of careers, and I still keep thinking. I mean, I'm at a point now in my life, I'm living the dream, finally. You know, we've moved back to my roots. When I started doing radio, I was a hippie up in Mendocino County, and we finally moved back to Mendocino County, which is where all those fires are. So I would like to see the marketing and the branding of this, quote, skeptical movement in a way that it takes its place in media. So reporters know where to go, and the public will begin to place their trust in such an organization. So I'm not saying I'm going to do that, but that's the kind of things I think about.
So, Dr. Dean Adell, thank you so much for joining us on The Skeptic's Guide and giving us your time.
It's absolutely my pleasure to speak with fellow humans on an important subject.
All right. Hopefully we can have you on again sometime.
That'd be great. Anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Good night.
And now, Randy speaks.
Randy, tell me about your investigations of the speaker cables.
Very interesting. Indeed, it's not a paranormal claim, of course, that's obvious. But if it were true, it would be paranormal. It's like homeopathy. That has nothing to do with paranormal or supernatural claims. But again, if it were true, it would be supernatural because there's no known explanation for it. Now, the fact that somebody out there is charging something like $14,000 for, I think they're only 8-foot speaker cables that go from your amplifier to your speakers, duh. Come on now. What could be the difference between that and zip cord, or as I've decided to use as a standard, monster cables? Now, monster cables are vastly overrated and vastly overpriced, but they're very well constructed and they're very satisfactory and they last a good long time and they'll take flexing and such. There are elements that you have to look into when you judge the performance of something like simple things like speaker cables. There's capacitance in between the actual conductors in the cable. There's outside influences, magnetic influence. You drape it over a transformer, for example, it'll pick up a hum very easily. So there are things that you've got to be careful of. There are other elements, and there are things that can be shielded against, like if you have an actual shielded speaker cable, that would be better in some circumstances, but not in many, because those influences are rather rare, but it would be an added advantage. My argument is that a person, I don't care how good their hearing is, person not being electronically aided now with detecting device and such, should not be able to tell the difference between a really good pair of conductors that go into a speaker system and a pair of conductors that are gold-plated and braided and malnutrated and crucibled and all sort of things that they... These are all bits of language that they throw in, and I just invented those, but they invent them too, so I might as well. My argument was that these people should take the challenge, and we had a couple of people agree to take the challenge, and they backed out, and then the suppliers of the cables wouldn't supply the cables. We even have doubts that that these very expensive cables have ever sold one pair. We don't know, and I'm not about to obtain the proof, I'm sure. The test would be very simple. We simply would do a double-blind test where by a random means we would alternate the speaker cables that were actually connected, though they would all appear to be connected. We would not, we would do a double-blind again, which means that I wouldn't know or nobody else would know what the results were until we added them up at the end. That's not a hard test to do. It's a very simple test to do. It's an A-B test. They do have mechanisms that they actually manufactured in order to test the difference between things like speaker cables. But I wouldn't depend on that. I would depend on an actual active individual, someone that we could all trust to do the switching around. We've got Scientific American interested in it. That is the editor of Scientific American, John Rennie. And we have the Wall Street Journal. A reporter there has decided to cover this subject. But that's been going on for months now. They've been back and forth on how they're going to do it or if they're going to do it. And I just sit there and I wait and I say, I want to see an application, a signed, notarized, sealed application in for the $1 million prize. And I'll put up the $1 million prize on something like this. And I haven't seen it yet. I'm just silly waiting for this to happen formally and properly and tightly. But they want to beat around the bush. Not the Wall Street Journal or John Rennie. No, not at all. But the guy who said, again, he will remain nameless for the moment, who said that he can do this sort of thing. It's very much like another test, that the test of the homeopathy business that where I swallow as many as 30 pills at a time, sleeping pills, and then finish the lecture without even yawning, except from boredom, perhaps. And I'm due to do that in New York City. The next time I'm in New York City for any period of more than 48 hours or so, the fellow's going to monitor me very carefully and make sure that he buys the pills in the store. Homeopathy pills don't have any content. And besides, the active ingredient in a sleeping pill for homeopathy is caffeine. because it works the opposite way, you see. Don't get me into that argument. But we figured out, of course, to have enough caffeine to intercept at least one molecule of caffeine in a large mass of homeopathic pills at the dilution that they use, you'd have to eat literally 16 swimming pools full of pills in order to make sure that you got one molecule of caffeine somewhere along the line. And I'm not about to try that either, because in a bathing suit, I don't look all that attractive anymore. There's not a call for that number in my repertoire. So anyway, getting back to speakers. No, I'm willing to do the thing. I'm still waiting for the results to come down to the finish line. I've even agreed to do it in the fellow's own stereo setup. And I have to trust him to that point where he hasn't got some gimmick going, because it'd be very easy to build a circuit in there that would send out a radio signal which says when one set of speaker cables were being used. But I'll just have to make sure that I have the ability to investigate these things and take a few simple instruments along to check them out.
Do you think that he is trying to pull a Sylvia Brown on you and forever evade testing?
Perhaps. I can't assign motives to these folks. But I do know that there's a great deal of reticence, reluctance to actually say, we'll do it now, here, and whatever, and set up the time and place. Wall Street Journal is, and the columnist there, and John Rennie, all very anxious to do that, very willing, and as I am. But we just have to wait for the future to develop, and we'll see whether this wonderful claim is accomplished one way or the other.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes, sir.
All right, here we go. Item number one, a new study finds that the recent increase in cesarean sections is due largely to concerns of pregnant women about the effects of vaginal delivery on sexual function. Item number two, researchers have found evidence that strongly supports the theory that a large comet or asteroid had exploded over Canada 12,900 years ago, triggering a mass extinction in North America. And item number three, researchers find that when communicating with hand gestures, people do not use the word order typical of their native language, but rather a universal order common to all people regardless of the grammar of their native tongue.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Bob, why don't you go first?
Okay, cesarean sections have increased due to concerns over sexual function.
These are all wordy items this week.
That sounds plausible to me. The episiotomies are, I guess, there's some level of risk with that. So I could see that being a concern. And then number two, the comet asteroid exploding over Canada 12,900 years ago, triggering a mass extinction in North America. Why haven't I heard about this? I would think that would... God, do asteroids hit Canada? I'm actually going to say that sounds plausible. I could see some little mini extinction going on because of that.
It's pretty big up there.
Yeah. I know, really. What the hell?
And then the hand gestures. Now, this one I am skeptical about. A universal word order. I don't know. I've studied Spanish and Italian, and word order is very different. And I would just think the culture that you were raised in, you know, their word order, like, you know, White House or House White, I think that's pretty much ingrained in your head through the language you were most comfortable with. And I would think that would kind of just translate through with any hand gestures. So I'm going to say that is fiction.
Already? Evan?
Wow. These are all noggin scratchers. No, cesarean sections, concerns because of the concerns of pregnant women. So since when do the concerns of pregnant women allow them to dictate whether they get a cesarean or traditional delivery? I'm a little leery of that. But I'm also a little leery of this 12,900 years ago asteroid exploded over Canada. Only because I could have sworn it was, wasn't the one that created the Chesapeake Bay around that time? So maybe that was over the United States. You could be trying to trick us there. And then communicating with hand gestures, people not use the word order typical of their native language. Wow. That one's... I wrapped my mind around that one, the native tongue. All right, I'll say that the cesarean section one is fiction.
Okay. Rebecca?
I was thinking that the cesarean section thing makes a lot of sense. I've heard similar things like that voiced, similar concerns voiced by women I know and also mentioned in the news before. So I think that that's, yeah, possible. A large comet exploding over Canada 13,000 years ago. I know that that was a theory, and I know that there are people studying it, but whether or not there's been new evidence found strongly supporting it, I'm skeptical of that. And communicating with hand gestures, making people use words in a different way, that makes sense to me too, because language evolves differently than what the human brain might necessarily be accustomed to or might be best at. So it kind of makes sense that maybe there are some languages that are not what the brain would naturally want to... I'm not really making myself very clear.
They try to say that culture trumps the native...
Yeah, see, okay, now I'm moving my hands around and I'm mixing up my subjects and verbs. And
are you saying words get in the way?
And I wrote a song about it, actually, and I'd like to sing it now. I'm going to go with number two. I don't think that there's been new evidence about the large comet exploding over Canada.
All right, Jay.
The first one about, so women are choosing to get more cesareans because of the potential damage it can do to their sexual function. That's what that one says. And I find that, I think I agree with Evan that it's kind of weird to think that they would even have the option. Like, can a woman tell the doctor, yeah, I want a cesarean? Okay, maybe they can. You know, I mean, it's their body. But that would mean that there would have to be an increase in information about vaginal birth damaging sexual function, which I don't remember reading, but, you know, I'm not hanging around those kind of message boards, I guess.
Or the gynecologist.
This seems like a weird piece of information. I don't know. I don't even know if Steve's weird enough to come up with this one. Second one about... with the mass extinction happening 12,900 years ago due to a large comet or asteroid. Yeah, I mean, that's so freaking plausible, even though I've never heard of it. It's completely plausible, and that's I would just say, yeah, just because I don't know about it, I would say sure that could be true. And then the final one, this is the one I'm really, really curious about. You know, it's kind of like that me, Tarzan, you, Jane thing, like, you know, you ever try to communicate with someone who doesn't speak your language with hand gestures? Like, I've actually done it, and it's so awkward. I would just think, you know, maybe there would be a similarity to the way people would approach doing it. You know, like, let's say you were trying to tell someone to go over there. Like, you kind of point at them and then point to the other plate. You know what I mean? But it's just such a nebulous idea to me. I don't know. I can't really come up with a conclusion. It just seems kind of out there to me. So anyway, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the cesarean thing is BS.
So Jay and Evan think the C-section is fake. Rebecca thinks the exploding comet is fake. And Bob thinks the hand gestures are fake. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Is that what you got out of
okay.
that?
Okay. That's good.
Okay. So, yeah, it's a tough one this week, I think. You guys are all over the place. Let's start with the hand gestures.
God damn it.
Oh, no, Bob.
Sorry, Bob.
No, Bob.
That one...
Is
science.
Yay.
That's a very interesting study. There is an ongoing investigation debate about how much of language is cultural and how much of it is hardwired in the brain, is genetically determined and universal among humans. Obviously, different languages have all different kinds of rules and word orders and grammar. But the big question is there a native grammar? Is there anything that would come more naturally than anything else? So this is just one way of getting at that. They looked at a number of people from four different languages, Chinese, English, Spanish, and Turkish, that use different word orders. And then they had them describe scenes that they were being shown verbally and had them describe it using just nonverbal hand gestures. And that's the key, is that they're nonverbal, right? That they're not just like sounding out words. They're actually just imitating visually what they're trying to describe. And regardless of their native language, everyone used the person-object-verb or subject-object-verb word order. So in other words, you might say, if you have a picture of a woman turning a knob, you might say that, like, in English, that the woman twists the knob. But everyone gestured, woman knob twists. Everyone did that order, subject, object, then verb, regardless of what language they spoke, which is interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. It kind of, the other thing that I've read about this kind of debate between culture versus hardwiring for language is that if children develop their own language, in other words, if they're not really being taught a specific language, and or if they, if you have when cultures get together where the children are grown up in a multi grow up in a, like a new generation of children being raised in a multicultural background where they're being exposed to multiple languages, they develop what's called a Creole language, and that Creole language is even completely different Creole languages have very similar grammar. And the thinking is that that may reflect the default grammar that, you know, that kids would just use naturally when they're not deriving it from the language.
And does that mean that they can cook really well with spices too?
That's very good jambalaya.
Yeah, like saying how y'all are, you know, that using just one verb form for that for are instead of other verb forms, for example. Or the word order that they use is more natural. So
yeah, and it makes sense just when you look at like how effed up some languages are. Like there are some really weird quirks to English that you're like, you know, who came up with that? It makes no sense. Why don't we spell everything phonetically? So yeah, I mean, it definitely makes sense that there are things in our languages that aren't necessarily the best way to go about them.
Yeah, so cultures are historically contingent, and then lots of quirky things got introduced. Yeah, that then just through cultural inertia survived, even though they weren't optimized. Certainly not. They're not optimized for efficiency. They weren't optimized for just what our default grammar would preferentially be.
Yeah, whatever.
I wonder if anyone, other than Klingon, I wonder if anyone has invented a language in the past 20 years or something that takes into account some of these ideas.
Klingon. Yeah. Well, you know, Tolkien invented Elvish. You know, he actually was a linguist, and he wrote those languages.
That wasn't the last 20 years.
That wasn't in the last 20 years, though. And I think Esperanto is older than 20 years old, right? I mean, so that would be that as well. Let's go to the first one. A new study finds that recent increase in cesarean sections is due largely to concerns of pregnant women about the effects of vaginal delivery on sexual function. And that one is fiction. So congratulations, Jay and Evan.
Thank you.
Although you both seem to get that one right for the wrong reason, the sort of concerns over whether or not women could determine whether or not they get a C-section. They absolutely can. I mean, you could have elective C-sections. There's a concern that part of the increase in C-sections may in fact be to elective C-sections, but due to convenience, not necessarily over concerns of sexual function.
Right.
In fact, this has the question of whether or not women are choosing to have more C-sections because of concerns about the effects on, you know, obviously like the vagina and their sexual function afterwards is not hugely studied, but what studies have been done show that it's a very minor effect. The big so in the last 20 years, C-sections have really increased dramatically, which has been concerning because the there were, you know, more potential for complications than vaginal delivery. The numbers have increased from about 20% 20 years ago to about 38% or so now. And no one's really quite sure exactly what the cause is of that increase in C-sections. The recent study that I was basing this on showed actually that one major contributor, so this is a new bit of information that was not previously known, is that women are giving birth older. And what the study showed is that older women, they have less uterine contraction. So they have their uterine muscle is not as strong, and it doesn't go through the contractions as efficiently or effectively as younger women. And that's leading to a failure for the normal or natural vaginal delivery to progress, leading to more C-sections. So it's just that women are giving birth older, and they're just less able to give vaginal delivery. Other factors that have been cited are the increasing obesity, because women who are more overweight have larger children, and larger children are harder to deliver vaginally, and so that could lead to more C-sections as well. There are some concerns that part of it is elective and for convenience. But there may be other factors as well. So this is still, you know, an area of investigation where they're not really sure they've identified all of the factors contributing to it. There is a lot of concern about these rising numbers, and there are sort of efforts underway to look into it and to with the goal of reducing the number back down to more like the 15 to 20% level, which is probably the level that's absolutely like medically necessary. Which means that Researchers have found evidence that strongly supports the theory that a large comet or asteroid exploded over Canada 12,900 years ago, triggering a mass extinction in North America, is science. And this has been an interesting story that I've been following. And we've spoken before about the fact that, like, the first Americans, you know, exactly when did they come over here from Asia? What pathway did they take? There were apparently a couple of different migrations across the Bering Strait or down the coast, the western coast of North America. You know, there was an initial flourishing of the Clovis people, but then they died out, and then the people who were the ancestors of Native Americans took their place. And the question is, what caused the Clovis people to suddenly really vanish from North America? And it also happened at the same time that a lot of the megafauna of North America went extinct too. So these were largely species that survived an ice age. And then when the ice age is over, a lot of them became extinct. One theory was this exploding comet theory, that there was a massive, probably not an impact because there's no crater, but just like we were talking about Tunguska, a massive comet that exploded in the atmosphere, but setting the forest on fire and, you know, altering the climate. What they found was that this is a geological evidence found in Ohio and Indiana by University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Anthropology Ken Tankersley, and working in conjunction with Alan West, and they found little, what they say, samples of diamond, gold, and silver that have been found in the region and sourced through X-ray diffractometry to date to that time. And they said the only real explanation for this distribution of this kind of material this far south would be that a massive explosion, you know, over in the atmosphere. So they think that this supports the exploding comet theory that happened around that time. So congratulations again, Jay and Evan. You guys did a good job.
Good stuff.
Thanks.
Congratulations, yeah. Guys.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
These were interesting stories this week, though. I thought these were
very wordy, though. You were right, Steve.
They were wordy.
It was a lot to absorb in a short amount of time.
It's true. That was my strategy. This was overwhelm you with content. Jay, give us a quote.
My quote is by Dr. Dean Edel.
I've heard of him.
Oh, really?
Love it.
I actually found a quote.
He's America's doctor.
I found a few quotes. Very hard to find quotes for him on here, but I found one that I like. It goes along with our interview today. So Dr. Dean Edel, I believe, said this live on the air. He said, "I can't believe it. Maybe there's a God after all. Herbal supplement sales only grew 1% last year. The years before, it was 17%, 12%, 18%. That's the quote.
Yeah. Okay.
By Dr. Dean Edel.
When did he say that, by the way?
I love you, Jay.
he said that in May 9th, 2001.
Oh, okay. So that's a while ago.
I have a quick announcement. My announcement is that I met these really cool skeptics from New Hampshire who listened to the show, and they were inspired to form a New Hampshire skeptics group. And they are having their first meeting July 9th. That's Wednesday, July 9th at 6:30 at Millie's Tavern in Manchester. Check the Skeptic calendar if you forget.
Manchester.
Go. Have fun.
Very nice.
Kick ass, New Hampshire.
Absolutely.
Live free or don't.
We're metastasizing. Right. And as I discussed before, check us out on YouTube and listen to the Skeptic's Guide 5x5. That's actually a second podcast that some of you may not either remember or know about. Only about 25% of our listeners are listening to the 5x5 podcast. So if you have somehow missed them, give that a look. You could access those right from our primary website, and they're also on iTunes. And as always, thanks for all of your support. Thanks for your kind reviews and your digs and all that other stuff. And everything, every little bit helps spread the word.
You bet.
And thank all you guys for joining me again.
Surely.
Thank you. Great show.
Thanks, Steve.
Fun as always. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Jim, run!
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.